From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Let's get the latest on the FAA's decision to ground all Boeing 737 MAX jets. Dozens of flights have been canceled in the U.S. today and many more around the world. The FAA is facing questions about why it took so long to make that decision after two of the jets crashed under similar circumstances in the span of 5 months. Here's FAA acting head Daniel Elwell on NPR's Morning Edition.
We make safety decisions based on what we know. If a link isn't made, you don't have a common thread, there is not a need for grounding.
Joining us now is Here and Now's transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Lisa.
So let's start right there. The FAA's default position while investigating and while the investigation was starting was to keep these planes in the air, even though other countries and other airlines had grounded them. It's being criticized, the FAA is, for being irresponsible for letting the public fly in models that are now grounded. And it was being lauded by some as being responsible by not jumping to conclusions and grounding the plane based on no real evidence of a problem. What do you make of the way the FAA has handled this?
Well, what's indisputable is that this is all very unusual. In the past, it would have been the FAA taking the lead and other countries and airlines looking to the FAA for guidance. Here we had the opposite. So the question is, did those other countries jump the gun or did the FAA drag its feet as sort of more pieces of this puzzle began to come together? And, you had the CEO of Ethiopian Airlines confirming that the pilot had indicated flight control problems with the aircraft, something that we didn't know for the first day or two, for example. Should that have been enough? Canada, when it banned the plane, said that it had seen enough satellite data indicating that it had enough, and it was only a few hours before this happened in the U.S.
So Canada had the information, but the FAA in the U.S. didn't?
Well, the FAA had said that it was exchanging information with Canada. So it's unclear whether the FAA had access at that time to the same information that Canada had. But what is clear that Canada acted on that information. This, by the way, rather new satellite data that came about after, if you recall, let's say Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, coincidentally, the 5-year anniversary of its disappearance last year. And people sort of said, well, isn't there's some kind of satellite tracking that could help find the plane. Well, this is that kind of technology that tracks airplanes much more precisely than it would have in the past. And it's been live now for a little while, and it was in operation on that airplane. And so, yeah, Canada basically said, and others felt this way too, based on various data points, that that this was similar enough to that Lion Air crash back in October, that it was worth taking this action. The Lion Air crash rather clearly caused, at least in part, by a system that was designed to prevent something that caused previous crashes, instead contributed to that crash. This one, while it's still earlier days, enough evidence anyway that it might have been caused by the same system.
So there are more than 4,000 of these MAX planes on order right now for carriers around the world. Are any airlines canceling those orders or switching to the competition, primarily Airbus?
Not yet. Of course, we're just a few days on here. Boeing's probably not going to get any new orders for the plane right now. And as we speak, it's building airplanes that it can't deliver. There's a strong incentive for airlines to stick with what they have. A lot of these airlines that have ordered this new 737 MAX, a plane that most of us have probably never flown on yet because there are so few of them. But a lot of us, if we've flown, have flown on the old 737s. Anybody who's been on an airplane has probably been on one of those. And, part of Boeing's pitch to airlines was that this plane was innovative in all the right ways, more fuel efficient, could fly farther, but had enough commonality with the old plane that they could just sort of drop it into their fleet. And so airlines, particularly those that had older 737s, really like that. And switching to the Airbus 320, for example, which you need different pilots to fly, different mechanics to work on, for them would be costly. So if they can feel like this airplane is safe to fly, they're going to tend to want to stick with it. That obviously being a big if that Boeing is going to have to take care of here in the coming days and weeks.
So the consequences for Boeing, we're seeing them now. We will continue to see them, as you said. What are the consequences for travelers? Very briefly.
less than the consequences for Boeing. Yeah, it's so in the U.S., so nearly 300 flights scheduled today on MAX aircraft. But that doesn't mean nearly 300 cancellations because of those. Airlines have spares that they use for even routine mechanical issues. They've also been planning for this possibility for days. The snowstorm today causing more cancellations than the MAX grounding.
Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you, Lisa.
Well, the crowded Democratic field of presidential candidates is growing. After much speculation, Beto O'Rourke, the former Texas congressman, announced this morning that he's running for president.
This is going to be a positive campaign that seeks to bring out the very best from every single one of us, that seeks to unite a very divided country.
O'Rourke became a national sensation in last year's contentious Senate race against Texas incumbent Republican Ted Cruz. O'Rourke narrowly lost that election. Let's get reaction now from Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons, a host on Hill TV. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you, Jeremy?
Doing well. And what do you think that Beto O'Rourke's entrance into this race does to it? Is this different than so many of the other candidates who have gotten in?
Well, it certainly feels like we're getting to the part of the race where the really big candidates are declaring, and all the, you know, all the big names are in: Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, and now you got Beto O'Rourke, and we're just waiting on Joe Biden. It feels to me that those are really the top seeds for this campaign. This were, you know, it's March Madness, so let's talk a little basketball. But that those are really the top seeds for the campaign. And so, what is exciting about Beto O'Rourke as a candidate is that he seems to be utterly comfortable in his skin. He seems to be willing to address a lot of the issues that are on people's minds without hesitancy. And in an era where social media is very dominant, he's a social media native. He doesn't really have to learn how to use Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. He seems like he comes already equipped with the ability to do that. So, to me, I think that's what makes this an exciting campaign. We'll see why he wants to be president and whether or not he can build the organization to pull it off.
And one of the other things that I noticed is that he recently said to reporters, "I am a capitalist," which is something that maybe some of the other Democratic candidates would be afraid to say right now because there's such a conversation going on about the economic policy of Democrats going forward.
Yeah, I think those candidates are playing short game ball and not long game. I think, you know, America is a capitalist nation. People come to the United States from all over the world to try to make a better life for themselves and their families and to escape oppression. Even African Americans who were brought here, like my great grandparents, brought here as slaves. 6 million African Americans left the South to go to northern cities for the same reason, to try to build better lives for their families and to escape oppression from the region where they came from. So it's built into the DNA to try to do better economically in this country. I think people who don't speak to that are missing a very key part of the American experience.
Let me ask you about the fact that Beto O'Rourke is a white man. In fact, his actual name is Robert Francis O'Rourke. He goes by Beto. But do you think that that's going to be difficult as a Democrat because the vote of blacks and Hispanics is going to be so important in this upcoming campaign?
Well, I'll tell you, I was just at a friend's birthday party in Dayton, Ohio, where there are lots of 75 and 80-year-old African-American women, her mom's friends, and they were all excited about Joe Biden. So I think that this is not the 2007 race where I think African-Americans felt some pressure to be with Barack Obama and not with Hillary Clinton. I think in this race, you'll see black voters and black strategists spread across the spectrum, as well as I think that's probably true also for Latino and Asian Americans. I don't feel that there's a real pressure around choosing a candidate that looks like you or has your ethnic makeup like there has been in the past.
I just want to listen to a little bit of Beto O'Rourke campaigning this morning in Keokuk, Iowa. Here he is.
I am all ears right now. There's no sense in campaigning if you already know every single answer, if you're not willing to listen to those whom you wish to serve. And that's what brought me here, along with hopefully a cup of coffee. So
he's got an optimism about him. I wonder what you think, Jamal Simmons, that President Trump is thinking as he looks not just at Beto, but at the whole Democratic field right now.
I'm sure President Trump is thinking that he can beat any of these people. He, you know, he seems to be a pretty self-confident guy. So I doubt that he's very nervous. But again, the thing about O'Rourke that is intriguing, and I got to tell you, there are a lot of, I have a lot of question marks about O'Rourke, about the things he stands for, and whether or not he can build an organization, and is he really, you know, someone who hasn't won a statewide campaign? You know, what does that mean when you're running for president? Mm-hmm. There are all these questions. But on the other hand, he also has this, again, he's a native of the same environment that Donald Trump is an expert in, which is how to drive media narratives without buying big TV ads and communicate with people in social media and get them to pay attention to him. Other candidates are spending a lot of time and money to figure that out in a way that I think Congressman O'Rourke doesn't have to.
That is Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist and host at Hill TV. Jamal, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the Trump administration's officials expressed optimism for some resolution to the trade war with China. The two countries have been going head-to-head over tariffs since last summer. In all the headlines about China, the lives of ordinary Chinese people get little attention. And that's something journalist Caroline Can wants to change. She's the Beijing-based editor of the website China Dialogue and a former reporter for The New York Times. Caroline Can has published a memoir now called Under Red Skies, Three Generations of Life, Loss, and Hope in China. It's just out this week. Can might be considered young to write a memoir. She turns 30 in a few days. But as a millennial in China, she wanted her experience to be known.
A few years ago, I read a few books done by foreign authors about Chinese millennials. And I thought, this is great. But I also hope there will be more Chinese voices. Then I think about the dream I had since I was a little girl, like, oh, why not? Maybe I should start writing some personal pieces and see where it goes.
Well, there's a lot you have to say. And you start with your birth in 1989. And at the time, it was under the one-child policy. Your parents already had their one child, and that was a son. So how did your mother go about hiding, as she did, her pregnancy?
If she breaks the law, that means she would never have the opportunity to continue her job as a teacher registered with the government system. So she, in the first few months, she hid the pregnancy from her colleagues and her families. In the later months, she had to basically escape from one house to another, sometimes stay with her relatives. Yeah, it was really tough.
She had to move from one place to another just to hide the fact that she was about to have another child, a second child.
Basically, there was the people coming to your house to check. And if she managed to stay at her uncle's, no people there know that she was hiding there, right?
When you were born, you had to be registered and get what's called hukou, H-O-U-K-O-U, which is part of a system that controlled migration in China. Now, this is a really central part of your story about where you live and where you go geographically during your life.
Mm-hmm.
How did this concept of hukou affect your life?
Because I was born to be a so-called illegal child, the process for my parents to get me a hukou took a long time. They had to pay a lot of money. Later, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my parents decided we should move out of the village to the town to get a better education. But because we didn't have a city hukou, the urban hukou, that was another struggling for my parents and us. Basically, we moved to a place where we didn't belong to that place, and people around us sometimes were not very friendly because we're the newer, and they thought we were coming to grab their opportunity, grab their jobs.
It sounds like you had a lot to fight through, and your parents had a lot to fight through. We should say that your mother did not lose her job, but I wonder what it was like when you moved to a more urban area from the village. You felt literally out of place. What was it like then to be growing up as a girl in China, a place that very heavily, especially then, favored boys?
Mm-hmm. Since I was at a very young age, I feel so like it's so unfair, like the way the teachers or even our family relatives, they treated boys much better, and they had more expectation, higher expectation on boys. The teachers even say in the classroom that, oh, you are a girl, maybe you are good at study right now, but after a few years in high school, you will just will not catch up with the boys. So, yeah, and when you get to a university, even in the cities, in Beijing, then you realize like similar kind of discrimination still exists in the cities. And when you go to find a job, the employer tell you that we only want a young man for this job, or you have to sign something to promise that you will not get married in 2 years and have babies. But this kind of thing just made me feel like Chinese women, even today, there's a long way to go for us to fight for our own rights.
But then how did you get the gumption or courage to work against that and go to school? You went to a prestigious high school as well as Beijing International Studies University. You know, you kept plugging away. Where did that come from?
My mom really inspired me. It's the way she overcame all the difficulties in her life. And she didn't do anything like super successful a career, but given that she come from a peasant family and she only went to school for a few years, but she managed to do a lot of self-teaching and managed to find her a job in school and later managed to have her own kindergarten. And my mom always tell me that you shouldn't be afraid of anything and there is always a way for you to fight and to finally achieve what you want. And also my grandmother, she had a very terrible life when she was young. Her dad was killed when she was 3 and she married at the age of 16. But she was always optimistic. And I think those women in my family really inspired me.
Those women inspired you, and they had very difficult lives, but made you see that there was a tremendous amount you could do, and you have done that. But it's interesting to note that it wasn't until you reached your mid-20s, when most women in China are expected to be married, that you discovered feminism. And you say, feminist notions of empowerment and equality were entirely new to me, but they also felt like home. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, the word feminism always have a negative color in China.
And it's considered unpatriotic.
Yes, but when I was in the third or fourth year in college, I read marvelous stories about those young women who are seeking for equality and seeking for women's rights. And then I realized, oh, so feminism is not bad. It's not like what we have been taught in school, that extreme or whatever. Then I feel like now this is a city, like people have realized that. And in the countryside, many women, like my cousin, she still doesn't understand what is feminism. She was not privileged to find a way to have her voices heard. So I think this is important. And I think it's also important for young Chinese women to stand out and tell their stories.
You describe in a very moving way at one point in the book, in really stark relief, what your life was like compared to, say, your cousin Chun Ting's life. And when you were leaving for college, you saw her and she was leading this prescribed path where she had gotten married, she was pregnant. What did you see in her eyes just as you were going off to get an education that you wanted to get?
Chun Ting and I grew up together. We were the best friends, best cousin, and we were like sisters, you know. And before I left for college, we met in her room, and I was so eager to tell her that I feel so happy. I was finally to go to the city and to see all the adventures, but I just feel like, oh, maybe this will hurt her feeling. So I just try to keep her happy and say, oh, we will still be close.
And have you stayed close to her?
Yes, but sometimes it's difficult. Our life are so different now. And she's a mother of a 6-year-old boy. And she doesn't have a stable job. She jumps from shoe factory to a wholesale market. And, you know, sometimes I feel like I want to share with her of the new things I discover in my life. I travel to America, I travel to Japan, I travel to many places in the world. But at the same time, part of me feel like I just feel, how would she think about that?
What would she think?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this make her even, like, sad.
So when you say the reason you wanted to write this book, a kind of memoir, you wanted, even though you're young, you want people to understand what it's like to grow up in China and what it's like for millennials in China. But at the same time, you're painting very different pictures of what that's like, looking at your cousin's experience and your own. So how would you describe what life is like for younger people in China now?
Yes, I said in the foreword in my book, I think it's dangerous to say sometimes that the whole generation is spoiled or selfish or don't care about politics. What I want to show is a part of what it's like in China, a glimpse of what a common Chinese family went through in the past 30, 40 years. Because I think it's a rare opportunity for people who don't live in that country to read those inside stories.
And from the other perspective, Caroline, what about Chinese perceptions of America?
So my generation grew up with embracing. We embrace the American culture. We watch all the Hollywood films. Like, we love Star Wars. We love Transformers. American culture was considered to be very cool. But at the same time, right now, I think there is a new movement, you know, because of Trump, because of the trade war. So in China, many people are arguing that care less about American culture and at the same time, like, be confident of China's own culture. So a lot of things are changing now compared to 10 years ago.
Caroline Kan's book is Under Red Skies, Three Generations of Life, Loss, and Hope in China. Thanks so much, Caroline.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
It's Pi Day. Nope, not the pumpkin kind. Today is March 14th, or 314, the first three digits of Pi. And not that anybody needs reminding, but pi is the number that represents the ratio of a circle circumference to its diameter and continues, like, to infinity. So to celebrate, we've called Emma Haruko Iwau, who is the new world record holder for calculating the most ever digits of pi. How many? 31,415,926,535,897. Emma Haruko Iwau is cloud developer advocate for Google. We reached her in Tokyo. Happy Pi Day, Emma.
Happy Pi Day.
If anybody deserves to have a Happy Pi Day, I think it's you. Before we get to exactly what you did, I wonder if you can tell us when your attraction to pi first started.
Of course. It was when I was 12 years old, and I was so attracted because the number just keeps going infinite. There's no end. And also, I liked computers when I was a kid, and I learned some people use computers to calculate millions or billions of digits of pi, and it seems so fascinating to me.
So what does it mean, though, when you use the cloud, as you did to calculate these trillions of digits instead of using a pencil and paper? I mean, you're not using a supercomputer. What does it mean to use the cloud?
Not everybody has access to supercomputers. For example, I didn't when I was a kid. But if I were born today, I would have access to the cloud. And I think that's the most important part.
That it opens it up to everybody. And how long did it take you to come up with this many?
So it took 4 months to do the calculation.
One of the issues here is also, as you say, your calculation took 170 terabytes of data to complete. Which may not mean much to the average person, but you say it's roughly the equivalent of the amount of data in the entire Library of Congress print collection?
Yes, exactly.
And so that's all stored within the cloud?
Exactly. We store everything in cloud. We store the final product, the actual digits of pi, as snapshots that you can copy to your own cloud projects. So anyone can copy these digits and play out in cloud.
Not to knock what you're doing. who would. But how do you know that this number is correct?
Oh, that's a very good question. If you miss a single digit during the multiplication, the entire digits will be wrong.
Yeah.
So if you check the last couple digits of the calculation, you know that the entire digits are correct. And we use a different equation to get the last digits. And we got the first 30 digits with different methods so that we can make sure the entire digits are actually correct.
Is there a practical application to this?
There are people who want to analyze the digits in a statistical way so that they can get into the features of Pi itself. And for engineering science applications, you probably won't need more than 100 digits. For example, you need 30 digits to launch a rocket to the space.
So, Emma, I wonder how you are celebrating on this Pi Day your discovery. This is an amazing feat.
I got a pie, actual apple pie, in Tokyo and celebrated with my colleagues in Tokyo, in the Tokyo office.
I think you deserve like 31 trillion pies for that.
No, that'd be awesome, but we had just one pie.
Well, you deserve it anyway. So thank you very much for speaking with us. Emma Haruko Iwao, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Today, a 16-year-old was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Greta Thunberg is a Swedish climate activist who will lead grade school students across the world who are going on strike tomorrow to demand political action on climate change. One of the youngest organizers lives in Colorado. Allie Budner reports from KRCC in Colorado Springs.
Haven Coleman is perched on the steps of the Colorado State Capitol in a puffy jacket and hat. With her mom standing nearby, she's holding up a simple handwritten sign.
It says, "School strike for climate," in big, bold letters.
The 12-year-old looks tiny against the gray stone columns rising up at her back. She's been speaking out on environmental issues for years. In 2017, a video of her went viral on the internet. She was questioning a U.S. congressperson about his support of coal rather than renewable energy. It was at a town hall meeting in Colorado Springs.
I was super persistent. I crawled up to the front of the room, stared that man down, and when he was picking people, I would jump up and he was like 3 feet away from me.
And she got his attention. Coleman doesn't actively approach people today, but she does get thumbs up and waves from passersby. Some stop to take pictures of her. Others ask questions.
School for Climate, what are you doing it for?
The crisis that we're dealing with right now.
She's given this response countless times, patiently breaking down the science of climate change to passing adults and explaining why it matters to her enough to leave school.
And I guess I'm fighting to like stop the worst effects.
Thank you. Continue to do what you do, and I will look at that climate change. High five, sister.
Woo! That was fun. That was the first interaction of the day, and it was a positive one. At least it wasn't like somebody flipping me off like 2 weeks ago.
Coleman was inspired by the growing worldwide movement called Fridays for Future. Students strike from school once a week to raise awareness about climate change. The movement was started by another teen activist, Greta Thunberg from Sweden. Thunberg has taken to regularly addressing the media and world leaders. Here she is speaking to delegates of the UN Climate Conference in Poland last year.
I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to.
Earlier this year, Thunberg took the momentum from her Fridays for Future movement to motivate tens of thousands of students across Europe to demonstrate en masse for climate. That's what got Haven Coleman's attention and Liam Newpert. He's the 16-year-old state leader for the movement in Idaho.
I had called my mom and I was like, so I'm going to lead a climate strike on the 15th. And she was like, what?
But like many other parents in this teen movement, she now supports him. Polls show young Americans are far more likely to believe climate change is happening and caused by humans. Still, Newpert says he was also inspired by the student-led March for Our Lives that followed the Parkland school shooting last year. He says the issues are related. Kids don't feel safe in school, and they feel like their world isn't safe either.
Like, if we don't have an Earth to live on, where are we going to go?
Amidst these existential questions, he struggles to find time for schoolwork.
I'm always, like, responding to messages and making sure our, like, social feed is up and, like, we're posting all the time. And so it's like juggling another life.
and juggling lots of very different peers.
Some people are pro-life, but they're also climate activists.
That's 16-year-old Marlo Baines, an activist from Boulder, Colorado.
You know, others are pro-guns, and yet they are also climate activists because they see this as an issue that we need to deal with.
Crossing these identity boundaries is imperative for the climate movement. That's according to Mishka Banuri, a Muslim teen in Utah.
I was so terrified joining this movement because oftentimes in planning meetings, I looked around and I was the only young person and I was the only person of color in the room.
On top of that, she says, in conservative-leaning states like hers, the conversations about environmental issues can be more challenging than they are on the East and West coasts.
In Utah, we're really at this basic level where we're still trying to convince people that climate change exists.
She says it's especially hard to be taken seriously as a young person, a reality that 12-year-old Haven Coleman can relate to.
Everybody tells us, like, okay, wait and, like, grow up, and then you can be a scientist and figure out, like, how to save the world. I'm like, well, scientists already figured out how to save the world. We're just not acting on it. And nobody listens to these scientists. Also, we don't have that much time.
Coleman turns 13 in a few weeks. It's a Friday. She'll spend it protesting. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
And Allie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. And by the way, we will talk with some Kentucky students participating in the walkout on tomorrow's show. Okay, let's go to London now for a story in progress at this moment. The British Parliament is voting again on whether to delay Brexit. You hear the sound of Parliament right there. And so far today, British lawmakers have already rejected an amendment calling for a second referendum on the UK leaving the European Union.
The ayes to the right, 85, and the noes to the left, 334.
They have also rejected an amendment that would extend the deadline for Brexit to June 30th. That's a month later than the original deadline, which is, by the way, in 15 days from now. They are currently voting on other amendments. And earlier this week, Parliament rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal for a second time and also voted against leaving without a deal. It's very complicated. Let's bring in Andrew Hilton, who's in London. He's director of the Center for the Study of Financial Innovation. Andrew, as they vote behind us here, what's your reaction to what you're seeing so far? A rejection, a resounding rejection of a second referendum.
Well, I guess nothing is really surprising, or everything is surprising. I've never seen anything like this in my life before. It's the whole polity in the UK seems to be breaking up. The old certainties just simply don't exist anymore. You don't know what's right, what's left. You don't know who's Conservative, who's Labour. And frankly, the shape of British politics over the next 20 years is probably up for grabs. It's really quite astonishing.
What do you think is at stake for the UK today? Let's start with the idea that there would be a delay. If they do vote to delay Brexit by a couple of years, what do you think that means?
Well, I don't know if it'll be for a couple of years because, you know, whatever we ask of the Europeans have to approve. We can't say unilaterally that we're going to delay Brexit for 2 years or even for a month or 2 months. That has to be approved by the EU27. The law of the land in the UK at the present time is unless anything else happens, in other words, unless that particular law is revoked, we will fall out of the European Union on the 29th of March. Doesn't matter what the Parliament has said in all these indicative votes. If they don't actually revoke that law, we fall out.
Do you think that the Europeans would allow Britain, though, to delay it?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is probably yes if it's short enough. Probably not if it's for 2 years. One never really knows with the Europeans because as I talk to people who've negotiated in Brussels, the answer in Brussels when you ask for something is no, 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 until it's 2 minutes before midnight and then it's yes.
Right.
And that's that was somebody who wants to remain, who doesn't want to leave. So you kind of don't know until the Europeans are right up against the wall. But they have a summit next week, and that summit would have to approve any request that we make for a delay. The problem that we face is that in a couple of months' time, the European Parliament holds its election.
Right.
And if our delay is beyond the date of the elections, which I think is May the 23rd to the 26th, we actually have to participate in those elections.
Right.
Otherwise, the new parliament is not legally constituted. Now, we had not intended to participate in those elections. It would be very difficult for us to do so. But if we did participate, then the European, the British MEPs in Strasbourg would have terrific leverage. So the Europeans don't really want us to participate either.
Well, Andrew, let me just ask you, just in a few seconds here, how likely do you think it is after today that the UK will just crash out of the EU with no deal?
I don't think it's very likely at all. I think it's more likely that we won't crash out of the European Union at all. It's more likely that there will be either a referendum or a general election, mm-hmm. Just because the cost of crashing out without a deal is perceived to be so great, both right. for the UK and for the Europeans.
That is Andrew Hilton, who's director of the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation in London. As we listen to Parliament, which is voting at this very minute on whether to delay Brexit. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure.
At a recent hearing into offshore oil and gas exploration, Democratic Congressman from South Carolina Joe Cunningham used this sound to demonstrate how disruptive oil drilling off the coastline might be for aquatic life. Joe Cunningham joins us now. What the heck was that anyway?
It was loud and obnoxious is what it was.
No, it was intended to be, wasn't it?
It was. It was. It was an air horn, and we brought that in to the hearing to demonstrate from a comparative standpoint, how disruptive and how destructive seismic air gun blasting is.
Okay, seismic air gun blasting is a part of these marine seismic studies for oil drilling. And what do they exactly do with sounds like that?
I mean, they blast them into our oceans to locate oil, and this is a precursor to offshore oil drilling. And they're looking at issuing these permits off the coast of South Carolina and the Eastern Seaboard. And it is extremely damaging to marine species and mammals like whales. And we brought the air horn in to just demonstrate that point.
So that's just a store-bought air horn. How do you know how much louder the actual sounds being made by those doing the drilling would be?
We use math and science. And I know that sometimes these days that seems to be a stranger in the halls of our Congress, but that's what we rely on. And we know the decibels of an air horn, and we know the decibels of this seismic air gun blasting. The official from NOAA did not know that, and so we you know it was incumbent upon us to educate him on that and educate the public how destructive this could be.
And actually, we have a bit of tape from that. We can hear it now. You are questioning Chris Oliver, an administrator for fisheries at NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and you're asking him to guess how much louder the seismic air gun that's used in these surveys is compared to that air horn that we heard that you used in the hearing. And you're asking him to pick a number.
10 times? 25 times?
Honestly, don't know.
I mean, can you take a guess?
No.
100 times? You think it's 1,000 times louder?
I doubt it.
Doubt it. What if I were to tell you it's 16,000 times louder than what you just heard here? Can you see how that would be impactful on marine species and mammals?
I do, which is why we put mitigation measures in to minimize the proximity of that activity with the whales in question.
That's Chris Oliver, who's an assistant administrator for fisheries with NOAA. So the way it would work is if this oil drilling goes through and there are five companies awaiting final permits from the Interior Department to begin testing, this is between New Jersey and Florida, if that were to happen, there would be a sound like this that goes off something like every 10 seconds. For what purpose?
It's just to send those waves and try to locate, you know, into the seafloor, try to locate pockets of oil and where they might be able to drill test wells. And it's, like I said, it is extremely harmful and disruptive to marine species, including whales, including, you know, animals that rely on sound to find food or to communicate with one another.
There are other people, though, who say, for instance, an industry group that has said that offshore drilling would bring $1.6 billion in tax revenue just to your state alone, South Carolina. I know you say that the rewards aren't worth the risks, but that's a pretty good reward for a state which needs investments, job creation, economic improvement, just as most states do.
I would disagree. I mean, South Carolina had about $22 billion worth brought in from tourism last year alone. And so
You think this would actually hurt tourism?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially a oil spill off our coast would decimate it, and not just temporarily, permanently, because people come to South Carolina for, you know, the hospitality, the food, the beaches, the environment, and this area, the 1st Congressional District, is doing well right now. And something like offshore drilling would literally set us back decades upon decades.
What's the next step?
Well, we are fighting this on every single front. We introduced a bill that would stop offshore drilling and seismic air gun blasting. And we are looking to bring a bill up in committee here in the next few weeks. And then sometime this year, I would expect to bring it to the floor for a House vote and then push it over to the Senate. And I would expect the senator, that our South Carolina senators, Graham and Scott, would do the right thing and get it to the floor for a vote.
South Carolina Democratic Congressman Joe Cunningham, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We are following the massive late winter storm covering a big chunk of the country. In parts of Colorado, Wyoming, and South Dakota, heavy snow and high winds have forced the cancellation of hundreds of flights, closed major interstates, and left tens of thousands of people without power. Meanwhile, in parts of Iowa and Nebraska, heavy rain is causing flooding. Forecasters say the cause of the trouble is the weather phenomenon we've heard about called bombogenesis. That's an intense low-pressure system. It makes winter storms even stronger. Yesterday in Colorado Springs, one wind gust clocked in at 97 miles an hour. In western Nebraska today, winds are gusting up to 90 miles an hour. We'll continue to watch this story. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.